Troy Anthony Davis has been on death row in Georgia for more than 16 years for the murder of police officer Mark Allen McPhail at a Burger King in Savannah, Georgia. There was no physical evidence against Troy. The weapon used in the crime was never found. The case against him consisted entirely of witness testimony. 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses have recanted or contradicted their testimony. Many of these witnesses have stated that they were pressured or coerced by police. And recently, on March 17th, 2008, the Georgia Supreme Court decided 4-3 to deny a new trial for Troy Anthony Davis, despite these concerns regarding his innocence. Joining me on the phone right now is Troy's attorney, Jason Ewart. Hello, Jason.
Hello, George. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining me today. Want to start off, if you can kind of start someone at the beginning, if you could give us the information about the police investigation, if there was problems with that, if you could talk about how it all happened from the beginning.
Sure, and I think that's the best place to start with this case, is at the very beginning, mainly because I think the investigation and the facts have proven that the investigation was flawed from the beginning. What happened? This was a hot August night in 1989, quite some time ago. Troy was in his early 20s. He lived in a middle-class African-American neighborhood in Savannah, Georgia. And the crime that ended up with Officer McPhail tragically killed that night started at a party that was near his home in his neighborhood in Savannah. And at that party, where there was 80 or so different people attending, there were several people in attendance, including Troy, and other people that would later end up at the Burger King parking lot where Officer McPhail was killed. And there was a shooting at this party, at least a block and a half down. The testimony at trial is nobody actually saw who had done the shooting, but somebody would jumped out of some bushes and shot some 4 kids that were riding in a car. They were all minors. And one of the kids was shot in the face, although it was not fatal. He actually ended up, I've met him before. He has done quite well, but he was shot that night. And about an hour or so later, after this party in Troy's neighborhood, Troy and his friends and many other people from the party ended up going to near a housing project near the Burger King parking lot that night. What happened next really was what the trial was made up or was trying to determine. There was a fight between one of the men that was at the party and one of the that ended up back near the housing project, and the fight was between this person and a homeless man who had just gone to buy beer at a liquor store and was heading back to the Burger King parking lot where he was spending the evening. On the way back to the Burger King parking lot, there a fight erupted between this other man and his name is Larry Young.
The homeless man's name is Larry Young?
Exactly.
And the guy who he was fighting, you can't name, is that right?
Well, yeah, it's best if I don't. We've identified him before, but
is it okay if I say his name?
Well, you can if you think you know.
Previously, we were talking with Martina Correa, mm-hmm. Troy Davis's sister, and Sylvester Coles is the man's name, I believe. But mm-hmm. you can't speak about him because of liability issues, some kind of potential.
Right, exactly. I mean, I can say what's in the record, and the audience can listen and take it for what it is. It's undisputed that Mr. Coles got into this altercation with Mr. Young, asking him for a beer as they went into the parking lot. They fought in the parking lot. Mr. Davis and one of his friends approached Mr. Coles and Mr. Young, who were fighting. And what happened next was the subject of the trial. Mr. Young was hit in the head with a gun, suffered a massive head injury. He began to scream, and after he screamed, the officer McPhail, who was off duty working at the bus station that was adjacent to the Burger King, came and responded to the call. After he responded, the same person, as all witnesses said, that had hit Larry Young with a gun, shot Officer McPhail. The other people in the parking lot fled the scene at that point.
Now, do we know who was hitting Larry Young? Because all of the witnesses said that same person shot Officer McPhail.
Yeah, and that's what we do know. We do know that the same person who hit Larry Young, pistol whipped Larry Young, was
right.
The same person that shot Officer McPhail.
Who does Larry Young say pistol whipped him? He survived this incident.
At trial, Larry Young said he couldn't recognize the person again that hit him because he had turned his head and it was hit on the side of the head and couldn't exactly tell who it was. He identified him by the position that his assailant was standing.
Was he drunk?
And
was,
really,
was Larry Young inebriated at the time of being pistol whipped? Was
yeah,
he also
he
drunk?
Had, he had said, and there was an alcohol test, a blood alcohol test done that night, and he was well over at least the 0.10 legal limit.
So that may that possibly could have been part of the reason he was unable to identify the individual that pistol whipped him.
Exactly.
So he didn't say Troy Davis pistol whipped him. He said he couldn't tell.
He was never actually. His first identification when he saw a lineup, saw Troy's picture, was to say that Troy was not the one that did it.
In the original lineup.
In the original
lineup. His response
to it.
So then, if the same person who pistol whipped Larry Young, if all of the witnesses say he is the same individual who shot Officer McPhail, how did Troy Davis wind up being implicated at all if original testimony, well, for one thing, as you said, Larry Young, the one who was pistol whipped, stated that Troy Davis, when looking at a lineup, was not the one who pistol whipped him, but these other witnesses said they saw Sylvester Coles pistol whipping Larry Young,
mm-hmm.
Right? Did they not?
Well, there actually, nobody at trial testified.
Prior to that, prior to the trial. Weren't
prior
there witnesses
trial,
who stated that Sylvester Coles had pistol whipped Larry Young and that they saw it prior to trial?
The evidence shows that some of the police statements described the man who assaulted Larry Young, and it's very important because that's the same person that shot Officer McPhail, as the person who was following and arguing with Larry Young immediately before that. That's what the police statement said. But, you know, one of the problems with this case is that the police statements, somebody's recollection that was recorded an hour or so after the event, and even their recollection 2 weeks later, the preliminary hearing here, not the trial, was eventually contradicted 2 years later at trial. In the case of one of the witnesses, Harriet Murray, she had described the shooter as the man who was arguing and following Larry Young. And as we talked about before, that was really undisputed in the record that was not Troy Davis.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that when it got to trial 2 years later, that she sat in the courtroom and said, "That's Troy Davis did it," pointing to him, sitting at the counsel's table.
Well, it is helpful now, though, that many of these witnesses have recanted to look back to their original statements to the police.
Exactly. And in a lot of instances, their original statements to the police are helpful. In a lot of instances, the trial testimony is accurate to a point. It's almost contradictory. At some point, they are they're pointing the finger to Troy Davis, his face, but they're describing the actions of someone else. And that becomes a problem with us. Because a lot of that was overlooked. And so if you have trial testimony where somebody is describing the actions that are undisputedly somebody else, not Troy Davis, but pointing to him and saying that's him, that there should be a discrepancy there. Unfortunately, that wasn't really that wasn't really fleshed out at trial in cross-examination.
Why not?
It's tough to ask. There was an issue with, a T-shirt. We knew there was a death discrepancy at trial. It really came down to people identifying who did what by a white shirt versus a yellow shirt. I mean, this is 8 o'clock in the morning in a parking lot with poor lighting. The difference between a white and a yellow T-shirt It was important to the jury.
I'm sorry, 8 o'clock in the morning, did you say?
1 o'clock in the morning.
1 o'clock, okay.
1 o'clock in the morning. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I think that the jury really saw the white shirt versus yellow shirt and took it that way. And the prosecution, that was their theory of their case, and the defense kind didn't present an alternative theory. And there really is one that was just yelling and screaming that, forget about the shirt color. It's tough to tell a white or a yellow. Maybe you got the white or yellow one right, but it's still tough to put the person in the shirt. We never were able to actually say that Troy Davis was wearing a white shirt that night, and that was the color of the shirt that people said was the shooter.
It's easy to look back, but
you got to look at the undisputed testimony of who was acting like what. Everybody said that Troy was calm, quiet, didn't say a word, wasn't acting aggressive, wasn't harassing anyone. That was everyone at the scene before and after that characterized him that way. And that somehow, out of nowhere, this rage came out and he hit Larry Young and shot somebody without ever getting into a fight or yelling or saying a word to anyone.
So you're saying that his defense attorney did not present another storyline of what could have happened. What if you were to be representing him in court at that time, what would you have presented as an alternative theory as to what went down?
The alternative theory isn't really an alternative theory. It's just don't pay attention to colors of shirts. That's a red herring. We don't know who was wearing what shirt. The only thing we know is that the other man in the parking lot presented a yellow shirt to the court. I could present a yellow shirt to the court tomorrow, especially if I had 2 weeks to do so, which was the time that he had to submit that evidence. Other than that, there was really no evidence to show that Troy Davis was wearing any wish color shirt. So to figure out two black males, approximately 5'11", that were rather slim, 5'11", 140 to 160 pounds, in a dark parking lot, what they look like from across the street, from across the parking lot, from while you're sitting there intoxicated, being beaten with a gun. Who did what? Which one did what? You've got to look at the characteristic that really differentiated one from the other. It wasn't their race. It wasn't their height. It wasn't their build. It barely was a T-shirt color. Instead, what you really have to look at is their demeanor. Who's doing what? Who's acting like what? We have that problem over and over again. We have a couple Air Force men that were sitting in a van in the drive-thru window. And most of them testified that they hadn't seen anything. I couldn't tell who did what. One of the witnesses actually swore out a police statement that said that he identified by shirt color, but said he wouldn't be able to identify him again if he ever saw him. 2 years later at trial, he actually identified Troy Davis. So there's a real question there as to whether that was accurate, whether all he had to do was point to the black guy that's sitting at the table. He was the only one. It wasn't too hard to pick out which one he was.
So were these the main inconsistencies at the trial, was that you had some witnesses saying one thing to the police in the beginning, and then later, 2 years later at trial, making these direct identifications of Troy Davis as the shooter when originally they were unsure? Are those the main inconsistencies?
I have to say that it's different for each witness. If one witness is describing one person in her police statement of an hour or so later, but points to Troy at trial. Somebody else, there are other witnesses that were more consistent between their police statement and their testimony. But you look at their testimony, and that's inconsistent with their identification of Troy. In other words, like I was saying, they're pointing at Troy, but they're not describing his actions. They're describing someone else.
Are you convinced that Troy Davis is innocent?
Oh, of course.
And what arguments would you make in court if he was granted a new trial to convince a jury of this? What would you say? What evidence would you present?
I think that part of the problem with it's a narrative to understand what happened here. You know, we have 9 of the witnesses that testified. 7 of them have recanted.
7 of the 9 have recanted.
So we have to understand that the question that everybody has is why? Why would you testify to something that wasn't true or that you were unsure of? And I think there's a narrative that goes along that explains that. And it has a lot to do with the way that the case was investigated. You know, this was obviously a tragic event, and it brought a ton of media attention once it happened. The Savannah newspaper and the Savannah media were covered with the story. It was a young, up-and-coming police officer who was gunned down. And it was on the front page of the paper. It was very tragic. But within 24 hours, Troy Davis, his picture was on the paper. Before all the evidence was out, before any investigation was done into anyone else, to anyone else in that parking lot that could have been the shooter, Troy Davis's picture was in the paper, not with the title of suspect, but they were speaking of him as he was the killer. The giant headline on the front page was "Police Hunt for Killer," with a picture of Troy Davis's face on it. And that was 48 hours or so after the shooting. This was on there were posters posted everywhere saying Troy Davis wanted, with a reward of $1,000 or so. Everybody was seeing his face, and at some point, new evidence came out that showed that it just might not be Troy that had done this. New evidence came out that nobody ever put Troy with a gun that night. New evidence came out that somebody else in the parking lot was carrying a caliber weapon that was the caliber that killed Officer McPhail. And the problem was that it was too late. This giant overcommitment to the theory that Troy Davis did this was already done. It was in the, you couldn't go back and say, oh, Police Hunt for Killer, just kidding, he didn't do it. He wasn't the suspect. That's not how they were talking about it. They had committed to him as the killer. And by that point, there was tunnel vision. I mean, that's the theory that I would tell the court, that the jury, that this is just tunnel vision. It's not even necessarily in bad faith. Perhaps they thought they got the right guy. But they didn't investigate anyone else. They didn't investigate anyone else in that parking lot. They didn't try to see if anybody else. They never found the gun that was actually being carried that night by someone else. They never searched anybody's house.
Did they look for that gun? Because the Sylvester Coles had a weapon. Did they look for it? Did the police try to find that weapon?
Yeah, I think they did, but they didn't get a search warrant.
What was his explanation for throwing a gun away?
I'm not, you know.
He had it with him that night. A cop is shot, and then he throws it away. Why isn't he a suspect?
It's a convoluted story. You know, it's to the trial record. We know that no house was ever searched. No search warrant was ever gotten. No arrest warrant was ever gotten.
What was the caliber of weapon that killed the officer? What was
right? His picture was never included. Or was included very rarely with any of the eyewitnesses.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it was included except for one eyewitness.
So
they saw only Troy Davis's face. Troy was obviously in the parking lot. The two, I would say, look very similar.
What caliber weapon was used to shoot the officer?
It was a .38.
A .38, and that is what, is that not what the caliber of the weapon that Sylvester Coles was carrying that night?
I think that's what the record says. Yeah.
Right. So where's the supposed gun Troy Davis had? Did they ever offer an explanation of where that might have gone, or did they just...
No, there was never a theory as to what happened. They searched Troy's house on the Saturday night after the crime, and they did not find a gun.
So how do you think this all happened? We have a crime that was committed. Troy Davis was there, it sounds like, but he was about the same height, the same race, and wearing a very similarly colored T-shirt to the other guy. Though he was acting, nobody claimed he was acting irrationally or crazy, yet the other guy was, and he pistol-whipped a man who everyone said was the same person who shot Officer McPhail. He right. says he threw away a .38 caliber weapon, this other man, Sylvester Coles, and yet he's not a suspect?
Yeah,
and somehow Troy Davis ends up on death row? I'm just not really understanding this. What happened in those 2 years before trial that led to him winding up with a conviction? It's, I know that there's, as you said, seven of the eyewitnesses who have now stated and sworn affidavits that they were pressured or coerced by police into testifying or signing statements against Troy. Is that basically what happened here? Was basically creating a case against him by coercing witnesses?
Yeah, and it's, I don't even think you have to say use the word coerced. I think that it who knows exactly what happened, whether it rises to the level of coercion, which is one of the reasons that the 11th Circuit has denied our evidentiary hearing to kind of sort this out. I don't think that matters. I think what we know is that there was a lot of pressure to build a case against Troy Davis, that a lot of witnesses gave statements that were contradictory to either their police statement or internally contradictory to their trial testimony. And then years later, when the pressure is off, come out largely unconnected and say, you know, what I said in court wasn't accurate. I didn't know what I was saying. I didn't see anything. What I said in court was wrong. And I think from that, we know from their affidavits too, and I've talked to them, that the reason they testified in the way they did or gave a police statement in the way they did was because they felt like they were being fed answers from the police that were investigating them. And this isn't a giant conspiracy that involved the entire Savannah Police Department. I think this is, you know, one or two possibly overzealous police detectives.
Basically lazy. They built a case against the person the media had already identified, and that they, the easy route, right?
And they may have thought they had gotten the right guy.
So who does Troy say did it? He was there when the shooting happened, right?
Well, Troy said he ran away as soon as as soon as Larry Young was hit in the face.
As soon as Sylvester Coles began to pistol whip Larry Young, Troy ran from the scene.
Well, you have to understand that. That Larry, the person who pistol whipped Larry Young, that's what Troy was convicted for. He was convicted of assault of Larry Young, as well as the murder of Officer McPhail. So the real question is, who did both crimes? Mm. So when we say Sylvester did that, that's not what's in the record. The trial showed that they convicted Troy Davis of that.
What does the evidence show, though?
The post trial shows that it could have, it might not have been Troy. And the affidavit, the evidence at trial that was used to convict him has been largely recanted.
So basically the most recent decision was on March 17th, 2008. The Georgia Supreme Court decided 4-3 to deny a new trial for Troy, despite all these concerns. If you could talk just a little bit about what the reasons were, what reasons were presented by the four who denied him a new trial, and then what were some of the arguments put forward by the three who supported a new trial for Troy?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Supreme Court, one of the arguments was, the main argument I think that they adopted was the idea that recantations just don't count. They're not credible, and we shouldn't ever really use them as evidence of innocence. They set a standard for recantation evidence to say that unless you can prove that the witness lied at trial and his testimony was a physical impossibility, that we're really not going to accept that evidence as evidence of innocence. They cite one case, and that's the kind of case that they say recantations might count, and that's when XYZ state witness testifies against a defendant that he sees the defendant doing something at a certain time, and it turns out that XYZ witness is in jail at the time, and they can produce jail records to show he couldn't have been where he said he was. That's the kind of case that the Georgia Supreme Court, at least four of the seven justices, wanted to see. Unfortunately, not every innocence case is like that. Not every innocence case has DNA. Not every innocence case has a videotape showing, oh, the jury might have got it wrong. Instead, you know, what we have here is we have seven largely unconnected witnesses that are not connected to the crime. They're not co-defendants. They're not family members. They really have no motivation to come out and recant their testimony. And they do it, and they do it in similar ways and tell similar stories. Yet, we can't prove that these seven witnesses, their testimony at trial was a physical impossibility. We don't have jail records to show they were actually in jail at the time. We know they weren't in jail at the time. We know they were there. We know their testimony is internally contradictory at trial or contradicts their police statement or in some way shows some indicia of truthfulness, at least their affidavit. Yet, we cannot show that high level of physical impossibility.
So four of the justices were not convinced by this. What about the three who would have granted him a new trial?
Well, the three would have granted him an evidentiary hearing, and That's largely what we need.
Would that be a preliminary to getting a new trial?
Exactly. All we've been asking for years is to get these, when I talk about affidavits, we want to turn these affidavits into real life people that can sit there in front of a judge, eventually in front of a jury, and convince them, because I've talked to these people, and convince them, not on the cold page of the affidavit, but convince them, like they have me, that what they saw was not what they testified to, and tell them the reasons that they've recanted. And they're very convincing, and that's all we've asked for, is this evidentiary hearing a day.
What about the two that haven't recanted? There's seven of nine that have. What about the two that haven't? Are they sticking with their original testimony? What was their original testimony?
One of the two is Mr. Coles.
Right, okay. So he testified against Troy Davis at trial.
Yes, he did. The second one was actually a witness that we've never been able to actually talk to face-to-face. I had mentioned him before, he was in a van in the drive-thru in the Burger King. And he told the police that night in his statement that was sworn under oath and signed by him that he wouldn't be able to identify the man again if he saw him. Was not shown any picture or any lineup for 2 years. Saw Troy Davis's picture in the paper the day before he testified. Got up on stand and identified Troy Davis in the courtroom for the first time.
Even though he had said he was too far away, originally had said he was too far away to identify the individual.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
So, you know, I don't even think the jury could, at the time of trial, could have credited his testimony or given it much weight. So, as the outlier here, I don't think it matters much. And as I was saying before, his testimony, like a lot of others, is internally consistent as well, because although he testifies and points the finger at Troy Davis, he says that he said at trial to the jury that the man who shot Officer McPhail was the man that was acting aggressive or fussing with Larry Young. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the demeanor that Troy Davis had, and that was just...
According to witnesses.
Right, according to witnesses, it's undisputed.
So, the original, at the time of the trial originally, the jury clearly wasn't presented a case that proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, from what I'm hearing here, and from what you're arguing to the court in appeals. Have any of the members of that jury come forward since and said they would not have convicted Troy, knowing what they know now about the seven of the nine recanting and knowing what they do about some of the original statements by witnesses that were contradicted later at trial?
Four of the jurors have come and signed affidavits stating that if they had seen, we showed them some of the new affidavits, and they said that had they known the information that we had supplied them, they would either not voted to convict or would not have imposed a death sentence, or both.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, the jury here has The dilemma we always come into is that the courts repeatedly say that they don't want to upset the jury's verdict. Yet, even here, we have four of the jurors stating that they would have changed their minds, and they wish somebody would actually change their mind for them. So it's a strange dilemma that we get into here.
So what are the next steps? As I said a moment ago, on March 17th, the Georgia Supreme Court decided 4-3 to deny, it sounds like, an evidentiary hearing for Troy.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we've been asking for years.
You're going to appeal that, I'm sure.
Well, we may appeal that. Unfortunately, the Georgia Supreme Court is the Georgia Supreme Court. They're currently we've asked them to reconsider their motion, and we thought the standard they set for recantations, this physical impossibility standard, was too high. It has nothing to do with innocence, and that imposing that standard might result in the execution of an innocent man. That's will be decided in the next week or a week or two. But the way Georgia works is they've got a pardon and parole board, the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board, five members, and they have the power to commute sentences from lethal injection to life in prison without parole, and life in prison with parole. And we're going to present them our evidence so they can take a look at it. And, you know, that's kind of how this whole case started. Was a year ago in July, Mr. Davis had a execution date on July 17th, and the Pardon and Parole Board scheduled a hearing the day before, is what they usually do. And they asked to see these witnesses that had never been in an evidentiary hearing, and had signed these affidavits way back 8 or 9 years ago, have been ready to testify at any point if we had gotten an evidentiary hearing in the court after court after court that we had gone to. And they came, not under subpoena. They came by their own free will and talked and testified in front of the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board. We could have, you know, it was scheduled conflicts, but we got five of the witnesses there, and the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board heard their testimony and granted a 90-day stay the next day.
So yeah, instead that was in 2007, right?
2007, mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of Troy dying on the 17th, they granted a stay, and eventually the Georgia Supreme Court decided to hear the case. Well, they ultimately didn't do anything with it.
So are you saying that this is his only hope at this point, is to go again before the Pardon and Parole Board and try to get him life without parole? Or is there something a little more hopeful than that you're going after here?
I don't, you know, to tell you the truth, I would hope that the Georgia Supreme Court would reconsider the import of their decision, their legal decision that's going to affect the factual determination or overlook the facts here. But I really think it may come down to the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board, and it will be a dramatic event. It will be the day before an execution date where witnesses, not by subpoena, not by any force of any personality or anything else, show up in Atlanta, mostly from hours away in Savannah and other parts of the country, and say, you know, when I testified the first time, it wasn't right. I wasn't right.
So the Georgia Supreme Court would reconsider this because you appeal or because
anytime you lose in any court, you can always ask them to reconsider their.
I see. So you're not exactly appealing it. You're just asking them to reconsider.
Exactly.
And they could just ignore you.
They'll say yes or no, one way or the other.
Okay, I see. So
they could say quite summarily. They could say.
And
no.
You think it's unlikely they'll say yes.
I don't. I would hope that one justice would change his mind and realize the import of
one of the four.
One of the four
that voted against,
the majority would
decide
realize the import of their decision, mm-hmm. and change their mind and realize the dissent wrote a very articulate, hard hitting opinion.
The three that dissented.
Mm-hmm. And I would hope maybe that would resonate possibly with them.
What's the time frame on that? When do they have to say yes or no?
Next week or two.
Next week or two.
Okay. But, you know, that's not a scenario that often happens, is reconsideration. So I really think the Georgia pardon and parole board are going to be the ones that ultimately decide this.
If he's given a new execution date.
Yeah, which
that's
which
what would have to happen for it to go to the pardon parole, right?
Right, which will happen. So,
which will automatically happen because he lost his
not
his
automatically. The trial judge will have to sign.
But it's kind of like a given that that will happen because of the decision in the Georgia Supreme Court on the 17th.
Right. Instead of a hearing where we can figure this out and listen to the witnesses and decide their credibility and you know, the matter of a day or at the most two. None of that will happen, and clemency will be the only answer. So,
And then at that point, he'd have no opportunity to try to get in the courts again. Would that be it?
It's really tough at that point. I mean, there's no real... We've been arguing this case up and down, asking for an evidentiary hearing here and there and to everywhere. And, you know, it's a complicated case, and I don't think anybody wants to deconstruct that. The easiest way to avoid that is find some procedural barrier.
Can it go beyond the Georgia Supreme Court? Could it go to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, when you go to the U.S. Supreme Court, you would have to argue there's a constitutional violation of some sort. They don't decide state law. And the decision the Georgia Supreme Court made was based largely on state law. We could appeal because we did make a constitutional argument. And we might quite well do that, but being heard in the U.S. Supreme Court is kind of like winning the lottery. They don't hear a lot of cases, and lots and lots of people ask them to. It's really going to end up being a dramatic event the day before execution. The remaining witnesses will go up there and tell them what they want.
Well, only have a minute or so left. I wanted to remind listeners I'm speaking with Jason Ewart. He is Troy Anthony Davis's attorney. Again, Troy Anthony Davis has been on death row for the last 16 years. He recently had, well, on March 17th, 2008, the Georgia Supreme Court decided 4-3 to deny a evidentiary hearing for him that would hopefully have led to a new trial. And, Jason, just want to ask you finally if you can let folks who are listening know where they can go to get more information about Troy's case and maybe some hopeful words about some things they can do to work on his behalf.
Well, of course. Troy and his supporters keep a website at troyanthonydavis.org. There's quite a bit of website content on there. Including summaries of the case, summaries of the evidence, links to the incredible press that we've had from Time Magazine, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, New York Times, Washington Post. And, you know, the best thing that people can do, and I know the facts are hard here, so it's not a question of whether you believe them or not, because it just takes too long and it's tough, but I think the issue here, if people really feel it, is that, you know, if this raises questions, and somebody's got to answer them. And asking for an evidentiary hearing is not being asked to get out of jail free card. It's listening to somebody, and it doesn't take much to listen to somebody. And what they really can do if they want to help is write a letter to the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board and say that, just simply say that this raises some problems in somebody's mind, and to give us a good, fair hearing and do the right thing. That's all I'd ask them to do.
Well, thank you so much, Jason, for being on my show today. I appreciate your time.
Sure, of course.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, that was Jason Ewart, Troy Anthony Davis's attorney. If you want more information about his case, you can go to troyanthonydavis.org. There's also an Amnesty International report, Where is the Justice for Me, at AIUSA.org. You can just put that in Google, too. Where is the Justice for Me, AIUSA? I'm sure you'll come up with it that way, Amnesty International's report on his case. And also, might not be in Georgia on May 17th, but there is a demonstration there at the Capitol, and if you know someone who lives in the area, you might let them know about it in Atlanta from 10 to noon on the Capitol steps. If you want more information about that, you can go to gfadp.org. That stands for Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, gfadp.org. Thanks for listening to this show, Peace Talks, and to the station Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. We'll be back in just a moment.